Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. How could the misplacement of a single microscopic protein entirely short-circuit the brain's communication network?
Yeah, that is the big question today. It really forces us to completely reorient how we visualize brain function. We are so conditioned, you know, to picture the brain purely as this continuous electrical grid, like a series of copper wires seamlessly firing off sparks.
Right, like a circuit board. But those wires don't actually touch, do they?
No, exactly, they don't. If you zoom in on that circuitry, there is a bustling gap between every single neuron, the synapse.
Right.
And that's where messages are just constantly being sent and received.
It's essentially a massive satellite communication network. You have transmitters firing these chemical signals into the void, and then receivers catching them on the other side.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
But in our deep dive today, we are looking at a scenario that challenges everything we know about that gap. We're exploring what really happens when the physical bridges holding our brain's receptors in place suddenly collapse. What happens when the receivers have perfectly lost their physical anchors?
Well, when that physical bridge collapses, the whole network it descends into absolute static. The electrical rhythm of the brain becomes completely unmoored. And figuring out why that static happens is a monumental task.
It really is. Which is why I want to say, today we celebrate the work of a massive global consortium of researchers and clinicians, including the Queen Square Institute of Neurology at University College London, KU Leuven, and the Scripps Research Institute, who have advanced our understanding of a newly defined neurodevelopmental disorder.
And it really took all of them to crack this. I mean, the sheer scale of the collaboration is impressive.
Definitely. And to really grasp the magnitude of what this consortium uncovered for you listening at home, we kind of have to rebuild that broken system from the ground up.
Yeah, let's start with the basics.
So let's start with the fundamental mechanics of how your brain cells talk to each other. When a neuron wants to excite its neighbor, it releases a neurotransmitter called glutamate into that synaptic gap. Glutamate is the major excitatory neurotransmitter in the human nervous system. It's like the ultimate go signal.
Right, the go signal. But to catch that signal, the receiving neuron has to deploy specific docking stations.
Right.
And among the most important of these are the metabotropic glutamate receptors, or MGLURs.
MGLURs, right.
Exactly. Yeah. And in this specific case, we're focusing on group 3 MGLU receptors. So things like MGLU4, 7, and 8. These receptors sit right at the edge of the synapse and catch the glutamate.
Catch the go signal.
Yeah, and sometimes they even sit on the transmitting side to act as an autoreceptor. So acting as a feedback loop to tell the neuron, hey, stop releasing glutamate, we have enough.
Okay, but if you think about the actual physics of a cell, it's essentially a fluid balloon, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
So these receptors don't just magically hover in the perfect location on the cell membrane to catch those chemical signals. They're floating in this slippery lipid bilayer. They need to be physically tied down so they don't just drift away.
Exactly. And that brings us to the star of today's deep dive, a protein called ELFN1.
ELFN1.
Yes. ELFN1 is a synaptic cell adhesion molecule. Picture a transmembrane protein that basically acts as an anchor. It physically binds to those group 3 MGLU receptors in a transynaptic manner.
Meaning it goes across the gap.
Right. It literally reaches across the synaptic gap to hold everything perfectly in place. But it goes beyond just being a physical tether. It allosterically modulates their function too.
Wait, allosterically modulates?
Yeah, it basically changes the physical shape of the receptor to tune it, making it more or less sensitive to the glutamate.
Okay, let's unpack this. Think of ELFN1 as the heavy-duty industrial Velcro that holds a satellite dish, which is the MGLU receptor on the exact right spot on the front of a house.
I like that analogy.
So if the Velcro fails, the dish falls off and the house loses its signal entirely. But my question is, if we know this Velcro is crucial, what happens to human patients when they are born entirely without it?
Well, the historical literature actually gave us a bit of a preview of how devastating the loss of that Velcro could be. In older animal studies, researchers deleted the ELFN1 gene in mouse models, and the resulting mice developed severe seizures and extreme hyperactivity.
Just from losing that one structural anchor, I mean, the brain's electrical signals were technically fine, but without the physical tether, the whole system just crashed.
It crashed completely. And the failure cascaded into other sensory systems too. Like, it severely impaired the mice's night vision.
Wait, night vision?
Yeah, because the ELFN1 protein is required to hold specific receptors at the synapses of rod photoreceptors in the eye. Without it, the rods are just functionally disconnected from the rest of the retina, and dim light vision fails entirely.
That is wild. So we knew it happened in mice, and there were scattered hints in humans too, right?
Right. Small isolated families had been reported in the medical literature where mutations in the ELFN1 gene seem broadly linked to intellectual disability and epilepsy.
But correlation isn't causation.
Exactly. The exact clinical spectrum and the underlying cellular mechanism of why the seizures were happening, it was all poorly defined. It was just a very fragmented picture.
So to find out what happens when this Velcro is missing, researchers couldn't just look at one isolated family. They had to launch a massive multi-layered investigation spanning human patients, lab-grown cells, and two completely different animal models.
Yeah, to track the failure across every single biological level.
It's incredible. Let's follow that investigative trail. Starting with the clinical methods, they gathered data from 8 newly identified individuals across 5 unrelated families, plus they integrated clinical details from 6 previously reported patients.
And all of these individuals had biallelic variants in the ELF1 gene.
Meaning they inherited a mutated copy from both parents.
Right, homozygous for the trait. By utilizing whole exome and whole genome sequencing, they were able to pinpoint the exact genetic misspellings in these families. We are talking about mapping the 1-2% of the human genome that actually codes for proteins just to find a single typo.
Wow. And then once they confirmed the genetics, they mapped the clinical phenotype. They used brain MRIs to look at the physical macrostructure of the patient's brains and EEGs to look at the microelectrical activity.
But having a DNA blueprint with a typo doesn't actually tell you how the building collapses. To see the structural failure in real time, you have to watch the protein being built.
You have to go down to the cellular level.
Exactly, which requires transitioning from human patients to cultured human cells. So to see why the mutations cause disease, they took the mutated human ELFN1 genes and synthesized them in the lab. Then they transfected these mutated genes into cultured HEK293T cells.
They essentially hijacked these lab-grown cells,
yeah,
right? Using them as microscopic factories to produce the mutant human protein.
Yes, exactly.
Wait. But if the cell is completely microscopic, how do you prove a protein is stuck on the inside of the cell versus successfully making it to the outside surface where the synapse would be?
They used two brilliant techniques for that. First, fluorescent tagging, specifically attaching a glowing green molecule called Venus to the protein so they could track it visually under a microscope.
Oh, nice.
But the definitive proof came from a technique called cell surface biotinylation.
Biotinylation. Okay, it's like trying to figure out which parts of a house are exposed to the weather. If you spray paint an entire neighborhood from a helicopter, only the exterior walls and the roofs get painted. The furniture inside stays totally clean.
That is a perfect analogy. That spray paint is the biotin tag. Biotinylation uses a chemical tag that absolutely cannot cross the cell membrane. It only binds to proteins that have successfully made it to the very surface of the cell.
So if they crush the cells afterward and find that the mutant ELFN1 protein has no biotin attached to it,
they know definitively that it never reached the exterior membrane.
That is so clever. It perfectly isolates the cellular mechanics. But seeing a protein fail to reach the surface of a solitary cell in a petri dish is still only part of the story. A petri dish doesn't have seizures.
No, it certainly doesn't.
So to see the behavioral and neurological impact in a living, breathing system, they had to move to their animal models. First, they observed mice. They tracked the physical movements of ELFN1 knockout mice, the ones born with zero working copies of the gene. They placed them in an open field test for 2 hours using automated tracking to map every single movement.
And then they moved to zebrafish. By injecting zebrafish embryos with synthetic molecules called morpholinos, they could manipulate the fish's genetics without needing to breed multiple generations.
Morpholinos are fascinating. If I understand correctly, they don't actually alter the DNA itself, right? They bind to specific RNA sequences and block them.
Exactly. It's essentially a molecular gag order. You're intercepting the genetic constructions before the cellular factory can even attempt to build a protein. So that molecular gag order effectively knocked down the zebrafish versions of the ELFN1 gene, which are known as ELFN1A and ELFN1B.
Right, and then they tracked the zebrafish's movements in a highly specialized observation chamber called a deneovision.
Yeah, but watching a fish swim erratically doesn't necessarily prove it's having a seizure. I mean, it could just be agitated.
So they took it a massive step further, and this is the part that blows my mind. They physically measured the brain waves of these tiny 5-day-old zebrafish using non-invasive local field potential, or LFP, recordings. It's incredible that they cross-referenced human DNA with cultured cells and two different animal species, but why go through the incredibly delicate trouble of measuring brain waves in tiny 5-day-old zebrafish?
Because the zebrafish brain, even at just 5 days post-fertilization, is a remarkably complex vertebrate system. By using a microscopic glass electrode to measure the local field potential in the optic tectum of the midbrain, they weren't just guessing at behavior anymore.
They could actually see the electrical storm.
Right. An LFP recording captures the aggregate electrical chatter of thousands of neurons. They were specifically looking for spontaneous epileptiform events, basically massive, synchronized electrical misfires.
So we have a huge mountain of data here. Human genome sequencing, glowing proteins in cultured human cells, hyperactive mice, and brainwave-monitored zebrafish embryos.
That's a lot.
The reason they looked at so many models is that the results from the cells and the animals perfectly explain the devastating symptoms seen in the human patients. Let's look at those human results first. Across the cohort, the patients ranged from 10 months to 21 years old, and they all exhibited developmental delay and intellectual disability, ranging from moderate to severe.
But the unifying neurological feature was the profound electrical instability. 12 out of the 14 patients had epilepsy.
Wow, 12 out of 14.
Yeah, and the onset varied wildly across the cohort. Some began suffering from seizures when they were just 15 days old. Others didn't have their first seizure until they were 8 years old. And they experienced a really brutal spectrum of seizure types, from tonic and myoclonic seizures to infantile spasms.
And when you look at their EEGs, the electrical mapping of their brains, it perfectly reflects that clinical instability. The recordings showed globally slowed and dysregulated background activity. The researchers documented abnormal spikes in waves predominantly in the slower theta and delta frequencies.
And the physical manifestations extended beyond just the seizures. Patients showed hypotonia, which is unusually low muscle tone, and ataxia, meaning a severe lack of muscle coordination.
And there were some facial features too, right?
Yes, there were some shared physical traits noted across many of the patients, like a thick lower lip vermilion, a broad nasal tip, and a narrow forehead. Though the clinicians were very careful to note, it wasn't a strict, uniform facial gestalt that appeared identically in every single patient.
To really understand why the electrical rhythm of these patients' brains was so chaotic, we have to look back at what the researchers found in those fluorescently tagged human cells. Remember those genetic mutations they synthesized?
Right. Some of them were massive frameshift mutations, typographical errors in the DNA that completely garble the instructions, resulting in a severely truncated, just completely broken protein.
But the most revealing mutation was just a tiny in-frame deletion. In one variant, just one single amino acid out of the entire protein chain, valine, at position 159 was missing. Everything else was perfectly intact. Wait, one single amino acid missing? Proteins are massive chains of hundreds of amino acids. You'd think a single missing link wouldn't destroy the whole machine.
You would think so. But structural modeling revealed the microscopic devastation it actually caused. The cellular factory successfully manufactured the mutated ELFN1 protein. But deleting that single valine 159 amino acid flattened a very specific structural ridge on the protein's outer surface.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. It's like the cellular factory built the satellite dish perfectly, but because of a tiny dent on the side, the delivery truck just never left the warehouse. The equipment is there, but it's useless.
It's totally useless. And the warehouse just fills up with it. When they looked at the cell surface biotinylation results, the mutant proteins completely failed to traffic to the cell surface. They were trapped deep inside the cell, caught in the endoplasmic reticulum.
Oh, wow.
Furthermore, when they ran binding assays to see if this mutant version could even theoretically connect to the Englob receptors, it couldn't.
Yeah.
That flattened ridge entirely stripped the protein of its ability to act as an anchor.
Which perfectly explains the electrical chaos in the human patients. Without the anchor reaching the surface, the receptors are unbound, the signals are lost into the void, and the brain's excitatory networks become totally dysregulated.
Exactly. And this dysregulation was flawlessly mirrored in the animal results. The mice completely lacking ELFN1 were wildly hyperactive, sustaining unusually high levels of movement for the full 2-hour open field test.
Wait, you mentioned earlier that the heterozygous mice were hyperactive too. If the knockout mice with zero working copies were hyperactive, what happened to the ones that still had one good copy? Doesn't that mean even a partial loss of this protein is enough to throw the brain's delicate balance out of whack?
It does. You'd assume they'd have enough of the protein to scrape by and function normally. But biological systems are incredibly unforgiving when it comes to the delicate architecture of the synapse. The mice with only one working copy, the heterozygotes, were also significantly hyperactive.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it demonstrates a phenomenon called haploinsufficiency. Having only 50% of the normal protein levels is simply not enough to maintain the brain's behavioral balance.
That is staggering. It highlights just how tightly regulated these synaptic anchors need to be. You can't just have some anchors, you need the exact right amount. And the zebrafish confirmed the seizure aspect of the disorder, didn't they?
They did. The zebrafish models with the knockdown genes showed intense seizure-like locomotor activity in the tracking chambers. And those incredibly delicate LFP brainwave recordings proved unequivocally that the fish were having spontaneous epileptiform events. Massive, uncontrolled spikes in their brainwaves that perfectly mirrored the dysregulated EEGs of the human patients.
Knowing that even a tiny structural flaw in this delivery system causes system-wide electrical chaos completely changes how we categorize and treat these patients.
It really does. From a clinical perspective, this multi-layered study officially establishes ELFN1-related deficiency disorder as a distinct autosomal recessive Mendelian condition.
For the families involved, having a definitive diagnosis after navigating the dark with unexplained neurodevelopmental issues must be profoundly impactful. It finally takes away the mystery. But beyond putting a name to the condition, did the clinical data reveal anything that changes how doctors physically care for these patients today?
It did, actually. It provides a really critical warning for clinicians. Mm-hmm. When looking at the brain MRIs, there wasn't a consistent, unifying structural deformity in the brain itself. Some patients had thinning of the corpus callosum or cerebellar atrophy, but others appeared structurally normal. However, there was one hidden, highly dangerous physical finding.
What was it?
One patient presented with a life-threatening subluxation of the atlanto-occipital joint.
The atlanto-occipital joint, if I remember my anatomy, that is the critical pivot joint where the spine meets the base of the skull, right?
Yes.
So if the brain structure is mostly okay, but they have these violent seizures, does the violent physical shaking put too much strain on a vulnerable point in the neck?
That is the exact concern, because these patients suffer from recurrent, highly unpredictable seizures. Any underlying joint instability at the brainstem could easily be exacerbated into a catastrophic spinal cord injury. So the study makes a definitive point to warn that doctors treating this new disorder must actively screen for this hidden physical danger, especially since recurrent seizures could worsen it.
That is a crucial life-saving takeaway. So what does this all mean for treatment? If traditional anti-seizure medications had highly variable success, and the data showed many remained completely refractory to the drugs.
Right, the pharmacoresistance makes sense when you understand the mechanism. Traditional anti-epileptic drugs often target ion channels to calm an electrical storm. But here, the root cause is not a primary failure of the brain's electricity, it's a structural failure of the receptor anchor. You're basically trying to fix the static on the TV by messing with the power cord, when the actual problem is a broken antenna on the roof.
So if we know the receptor is just missing its anchor, could future pharmacology skip the anchor entirely and just directly activate those unbound receptors to restore the brain's electrical balance?
That is precisely where the field needs to focus next. Because the root cause is a synaptic dysfunction, future treatments might need to bypass the anchor entirely and focus on neuroplasticity, or drugs that directly modulate the floating synapses. We might need positive allosteric modulators for those specific receptors, chemicals that force the receptors to activate and stabilize the synapse, even without their natural Velcro tether.
Let's distill all of this complex genetics and neuroscience down to its core for you listening at home. ELFN1 is a vital structural anchor required to hold neurotransmitter receptors perfectly in place at the brain's synapses.
And when genetic mutations prevent this anchor from reaching the cell surface, it completely disrupts synaptic communication.
The result is a severe, newly defined condition called ELFN1 deficiency disorder, characterized by intellectual disability and severe epilepsy. By tracking a single mutated gene through cultured cells, hyperactive mice, and microscopic zebrafish brains, this global team traced exactly how a missing microtropic anchor leads to macro-level neurological chaos.
It's a huge step forward. It forces us to ask new questions about every neurodevelopmental disease we thought we understood.
Which leads to a final thought for you to ponder. What does this mean for how we approach other unexplained brain disorders? Could the root problem often not be the brain's electrical signals themselves, but simply the missing microscopic anchors meant to catch them?
It entirely changes the diagnostic landscape.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Sparks in a wired up mind. Messages knocking, but they can't align. A door in the synapse won't open wide, so the current stutters nowhere to hide. If the anchor can't reach the outer skin, the whispers fade where they should begin. No handshake held, no rhythm stays. Just run away, flashes in crowded waves. When the signal won't land, the whole world shakes. Lightning in the quiet and the body breaks. But we trace the fault line, name what's gone wrong. Find the lost connection, bring it back strong. Target the synapse, let the future steer.